This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. Thank you for tuning in. A lot of interesting developments in the world have happened this past week, and we want to point you to the bits that we feel are most important, the events that are likeliest to have the biggest impact on the world in the long run. And a lot of times, it's not at all what you're going to see in any other news source. That's definitely the case this week. We're going to talk about some important items that no other source outside the Trumpet is really even looking at. I have with me here in the studio some of our writing staff, Robert Morley.
Hi there.
Jeremiah Jacques.
Good to be here.
Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
And Richard Palmer via Skype from our office in Britain.
Hello.
So, in last Friday's program, we focused on the strongman in Russia, Vladimir Putin. Forbes this week called him the most powerful man in the world. America's president was number three. Germany's Angela Merkel was number two. Very interesting poll there. But this week, for our top story, we're going to focus on the stage being set for the rise of a strong man in Europe. Our front page story in the newest edition of the Trumpet Weekly. Gutenberg condemns Europe's leadership, written by our very own Richard Palmer. Richard, tell us what you observed this week.
Yeah, so today I wanted to talk about the appearance of Carter Del Zu Gutenberg at the Fortune Global Forum in California this week. Now, Zu Gutenberg is someone the Trumpet has had we've had our eye on him for a while. He had a very promising political career in Germany a few years ago that ended up ending in a big plagiarism scandal where he was found to have plagiarized his doctrinal thesis. But for a while there, he was the most popular politician in Germany and had a pretty quick rise. Now, he's been out of politics for a few years, but now his country's in trouble. His political party, the CSU, is in trouble. And he's just starting to get back involved in German politics. He's kind of sat it out for a while. He's paid his penalty for that scandal. And if Germans want solutions for the problems, they may well start going back to Zu Gutenberg. And we just had actually a couple of articles that touch on this and on him and his career in our latest print edition of The Trumpet. And you can read both of those. They're on our front page at thetrumpet.com right now, or you can get a free subscription to The Trumpet magazine there to get a bit more background on this individual and on why we're watching him. But going back to this appearance at the Fortune Global Forum, so it's one of the more extensive public appearances in English that we've had from Zu Gutenberg in quite a long time. He does pop up occasionally. He'll give an interview on CNN for a couple of minutes, or he'll write an article. But this was he was participating in a 45-minute long panel discussion on the subject of global volatility. And so it was a really great opportunity to hear in English, Zu Gutenberg's thoughts on the big substantive issues of the day. And they did talk about those issues. They started with the immigration crisis. They talked a lot about the other crises Europe's faced. They talked about the rise of China. They talked about the rise of Russia, what the world would look like over the next 5-10 years, how stable or unstable it would be. So it was really the biggest, the most serious issues facing the world that they were discussing here. And it was great to get some, to hear what he thinks about these things.
And just in your view, how locked in, how aware of the big picture of what's going on in the world is he?
Very much aware, very locked in. I was impressed not just with how clearly he saw the problems the world faced, and especially the problems Europe faces, but he was able to articulate those problems very clearly as well. Almost as a writer, I was a little bit jealous, to be honest, because he was just so good at putting these problems in very simple terms and just really explaining and getting to the heart of what is going on, what is going wrong, what the problems are, what the solutions are, and just plain English and in a way that anyone can understand. And that itself shows how much thought he's given to those subjects, because that's not easy to do.
So let's just talk a little bit about this clip. Stephen Fleury played this morning on the Trumpet Daily program radio show. We've got it on thetrumpet.com. It's only, a minute 40 seconds, but he packs a lot into this quote.
Yeah, this clip really covered some of the best quotes from Zu Gutenberg that he gave during this discussion.
I mean, to me, the big thing that stands out is he gets to, when he starts getting down to the heart of all of the problems that Europe faces, to him, it all gets back to leadership.
Mm-hmm.
He was talking about the immigration crisis a little before this clip, and he was talking about the problems with the internal squabblings politically within Germany, the problems within Europe with all this squabbling and infighting and not enough leadership. Then you get into this clip, and he was talking about how Europe just keeps having this problem and that problem. He talks about how Germany inevitably is going to have a major terrorist attack, and that there's no real leadership in dealing with these problems or being proactive. Europe is fundamentally reactive. They're just coming up with short-term solutions as each problem hits them. And he had this great analogy of Europe being like a patient on the operating table, surrounded by 27 doctors. And of course, that whole thing is just a crowded, chaotic mess. And he developed this analogy and talking about how every now and again somebody trips over the power cord to the heart-lung machine and the patient's dying. They all panic. They finally get it plugged in again. And everyone, you know, kind of breathes a sigh of relief. But fundamentally, they've made no progress. They've not fixed anything. All they've done is prevented that particular catastrophe.
Well, you know, what really struck me about that analogy was he was talking about the skillfulness of each of the people standing around the table. All of these surgeons, they're very good at their jobs, but they're just that there are too many of them. And then he made some allusion to the fact that none of these individuals who are controlling the levers of power, say, within their individual nations, are willing to not be reelected in order to serve the greater good and so that the whole European project can move forward. So there was just a really strong appeal to the need for much less leadership or much less individuality and sovereignty of the individual member states within Europe for the sake of moving ahead with a unified purpose going forward. And like you said, it all came down to leadership. It all came down to the fact that there are too many surgeons around the table. There are too many cooks in the kitchen. We really do need a singular, unified vision driving Europe forward.
Yes, and actually after that clip ended, the panel went on to discuss the head doctor of those 27-28 doctors around the table. And of course, the head doctor is Angela Merkel. And he talked about how Angela Merkel in that is just overawed, I think was his word, with being in charge and with being a leader. He talked about how she just tends to have this leading from behind with ad hoc solutions. He talked about how there was once a time she could have really gotten Europe to have a debate about a substantive issue and look at really solving it, but that time is gone, which that's some of the most critical I've heard him of his former boss, and someone even that he still, at least until fairly recently, would have meetings with, etc. So he's when he's talking about leadership, he then, you know, he starts zeroing in on German leadership and the problem being that Germany is not taking that role. I mean, he wasn't quite that strong in talking about it, but that Germany isn't stepping up to its position as head doctor and actually starting to solve some of this.
Not difficult to see why or how this message would resonate among Germans. I mean, this is really when Merkel is very vulnerable, and there are a lot of people that have turned against her, and now he's saying this, and he's talking about the need for, you know, someone to step up and to resolve these things.
Yeah, absolutely. Merkel is very vulnerable right now, and that immigration crisis is generating a lot of dissatisfaction, and we have a great article about some of that in the Trumpet Weekly. But another thing that I thought was just really interesting from Gutenberg, just sticking with this immigration crisis, is that he did talk about how he didn't see it as all bad news, and he said that he thought it could lead to a cathartic moment, was the term he used, a kind of moment of healing. And he said that it could be an opportunity for Europe to kind of put an end to some of its founding lies. Again, that's, I believe, the terminology he used. And this idea of a Europe of equals and a Europe of where each nation kind of wants the same thing. And he said that it could force Europe to find some real and some long-term solutions to its problems, which I think is really interesting because that's exactly the analysis that we've had at the Trumpet on this, on the Euro crisis and then on the immigration crisis. is that it is going to force Europe to face these problems rather than just avoid them. And eventually they're going to have to stop kicking the can down the road. So it's really interesting that Gutenberg is thinking in exactly this way.
But using a very interesting euphemistic type of terminology to describe it, cathartic and healing. And really what we talk about so often is the fact that it's crises that provoke Europe into taking the kind of action that it needs to take in order to move forward.
And it's also important to note this wasn't the immigration crisis. That's not by far the only crisis that Gutenberg touched on here. I really like one of the comments, actually, one of the other participants at this panel discussion talked about. And he made the point that with the immigration crisis, with the Charlie Hebdo attack, he called these 9/11 type events, right, or 9/11 scale events that are hitting Europe. And he identified three that had hit Europe just in the past year or so alone. And he said, with all the volatility that's going on in the world, we're going to see more and more of these 9/11 type events hitting Europe, just to use his language. And so you can see how there's going to be more and more pressure now coming on Europe as these events hit to come up with these proper solutions, to come up with these long-term solutions to all of those problems.
Right. Like you said, that's exactly what we've been talking about. It goes back to, or reminds you of the statement that Herbert W. Armstrong made about it being a crisis that provokes Europe to unite into this formation of 10 kings that we've been talking about. And really, that's been kind of the way that it's been for Europe from the very beginning of this project.
Absolutely. And I think the slightly different point, though, that they were also making is because this was a panel discussion on global volatility, and all three of the participants here very clearly had the view that the world ahead is going to be much more volatile. And so Zu Gutenberg, for example, was talking about, when asked, what's the world going to be like over the next 5 years? How are things going to change for business people over the next 5 years? Because it was mainly a business event. He said, business people are going to have to pay a lot more attention to geopolitical events. So there's going to be these big geopolitical events, clashes, etc., that are going to have much more of an impact on the way people run their businesses and a much more impact on people just trying to get on and import, export, make money, create products. So they all very clearly saw a dangerous and a volatile world. So even beyond those crises that were kind of designed, like the euro crisis and these maybe foreseen and foreseeable ones, the world itself is just going to become a much more dangerous place. And that progression over the next few years is going to force Europe to make some changes.
So it's interesting. I mean, it had to have been pretty chilling to just listen to this and to hear the kinds of thoughts that are on his mind, looking at the problems that are in the world and his response to these. This is coming at an interesting time. Just the fact that he is, as you mentioned earlier, he's just starting to get back into German politics, and this does give us some insight into his views that could really resonate with people and raise his profile politically.
Yes. Yeah. Just a few days ago, I think it was the 26th of October, Spiegel had an article that I thought was really fascinating because it was just a short piece. But Zu Gutenberg's comeback in German politics, it was originally billed as a pretty minor role. He was one of a group of advisors who would be advising Horst Seehofer, who's the leader of the Christian Social Union, on the Christian Social Union, the CSU strategy in upcoming elections. And his role was just to advise on foreign policy. So that's a pretty, on the surface, academic, kind of in the background role, not really a very public face. However, Spiegel's article was talking about how actually Seehofer had put together this five-man team or five-person team. I believe there were some women on the team as well. And Zu Gutenberg is one of those five. And that Seehofer planned to use this team as a training ground for future leaders. So he's seeing Zu Gutenberg not just as a past leader, as it has been, but somebody as a future leader within the CSU. And it's not hard to see why, because the kind of favorite to take Seehofer is scheduled to retire. I think he said he'd retire by 2018. The one that's expected to replace him is Markus Söder. And this article was raising eyebrows that Söder wasn't on this advisory team, and he hasn't been appointed to any kind of important positions under Seehofer. And the thinking is Seehofer doesn't want Söder to replace him. He's looking for other people to replace him, other people to fulfill those leadership roles. And so Gutenberg used to be phenomenally popular, and so he's kind of now put Zu Gutenberg in this position where he's starting a comeback and potentially training now to maybe even have a bid as leader of the CSU.
It's pretty amazing. We will definitely have to keep our eyes on this. So, Richard, before we move on, I just wanted to give you an opportunity to give us the overview of any other headlines from Europe that you thought would be good to talk about this week.
Yes, well, we started talking about the Balkans for our top story in Europe last week. And so I'll start with them. They're back in the news. German Chancellor Angela Merkel said that if she closed the German border with Austria, she said that she was worried that could see the reemergence of military conflicts within the Balkans. And I think that's a very interesting statement. She sees how unstable things are generally in that region. And she knows that when times get tough, when resources are scarce, that can lead to more unrest, more conflict, as people just try to grab hold of what they can and go back to looking to their own ethnic group for defense. And so she's worried about increasing the instability down there or increasing the pressure on there because she sees a very clear potential for conflict. And Slovenia's prime minister made very similar comments. Then just going just north of the Balkans, Romania's government collapsed this week. So last weekend, there was a fire in a nightclub that killed 30 people. And that kind of just added to an already very strong protest movement about government corruption. And that was increased that to the point and increased the pressure on the government to the point that the prime minister resigned. They've appointed a new prime minister. They're due to hold elections next year anyway. But there's growing political instability there. And if you look at where Romania is, they're right next to the Balkans. They're very close to Ukraine. So there is a chance, probably still a small chance, but a chance that they could get drawn into the general instability down in that region. Then going back to German politics that we touched on a bit with Zu Gutenberg, the leaders of Germany's three main parties met to kind of talk out their response to the migration crisis. And they meant to agree that over the weekend. They couldn't. They did finally proclaim their agreement on Thursday, and there was a small concession made to Horst Seehofer and the CSU about setting up special centers to quickly process migrants who won't be allowed to stay in Germany. But it's just a small concession. If it does dampen the political squabbling in German politics, it will only do so for a pretty short amount of time. It doesn't really come close to dealing with the immigration crisis. So we'll see more that division that Zu Gutenberg lamented in German politics. That's only going to continue. And then finally, we'll just mention that a couple of books came out on the Vatican and the Catholic Church this week, detailing a lot of the corruption there. Mr. Flurry spoke about that on his Trumpet Daily Radio. But basically, there's a lot of accusations of financial mismanagement and dodgy dealings.
You're listening to our Week in Review program. We're looking at the big stories from around the world from this past week. We're transitioning now to the Middle East. Brent, let's look at the overview of headlines.
The Wall Street Journal reported on Wednesday this week that Iran's Revolutionary Guard has stepped up its hacking of email and social media accounts from people working in the Obama administration. And the specific people that were hacked over the last few weeks came from the State Department's Office of Iranian Affairs and the Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs. So they're all going after information related to the people that are mostly concerned with them and affairs in Iran, following which this week there was an arrest in Iran of an American businessman. He was arrested for espionage, for spying. So there are some fruits of that. I don't know whether he was necessarily a spy. They have arrested a couple of businessmen inside Iran for what they say is espionage. Also, looking forward this weekend, we've got the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is going to meet with President Obama. They haven't met face-to-face for a while. Well, on Wednesday, it came out this week that Netanyahu nominated Ran Baratz to head up the media directive in Israel. And this is a man that in the past has called Obama's policy with Iran and Israel anti-Semitic. So the administration is wanting, the American administration is wanting an apology for that.
All right. And your top story for the week?
My top story is all about Egypt. There is one story in the Trumpet Weekly this week concerning Egypt and their Egypt's concerns over what's taking place in Libya. Obviously, Egypt's been in the news over the past week or so because of the airliner that crashed in the Sinai Peninsula after taking off from the tourist town of Sharm el-Sheikh. It was mainly had Russians on board. Today, it came out that Russia is actually suspending all its flights all through Egypt, not just to the Sinai Peninsula. The UK and some airlines in Europe have done that to the Sinai Peninsula. But that was big news today that Russia is pulling out its flights as well, which will have a pretty big economic impact on the tourism inside Egypt. But mainly, I want to look at a couple of things about that show that the leadership of Egypt, President Abdel el-Sisi, or Fattah Abdel el-Sisi, he is in danger right now of losing his grip on power. And there's a number of reasons for that. And there's a number of reasons why we watch this as well. We watch for this strongman to lose power eventually and for an Islamist government to take over inside Egypt. Now, this man, he has ruled with a strong hand. He did take over the government in a military coup, the government of President Morsi, the Muslim Brotherhood leader, a few years back. And while we don't condone all his actions for sure inside Egypt, he has been a pretty strong supporter of Israel and a strong supporter of the American alliance in the face of growing Islamist extremism all over the Middle East. Just this week, he stunned the Arab world because he, for the first time in Egypt's history, they actually voted with Israel at the United Nations. That's never, ever happened. It wasn't necessarily an important thing. They were voting on a committee of, I forget what the committee name was, but it was something about outer space, being an observer for actions in outer space. And they voted for Israel to join that committee. And the Arab world was in an uproar for it. Sisi said, well, he was trying to work out his own political advantage through this. But nevertheless, I mean, that's a pretty big symbol and a big gesture towards Israel. So you can see that there would be other Arab leaders that aren't happy with the way that he is moving the nation. Just today, he is in the UK talking with Prime Minister David Cameron. And while there, his main mission is to talk about Libya and the situation with Libya. Libya is on the western coast of Egypt, shares a massive border. And we know that ever since the ouster of Muammar Gaddafi a couple years back, the NATO mission that bombed him, that ended up seeing him dragged through the streets by Islamists, that after that bombing campaign, we pretty much had a situation where there was no boots on the ground, there was no follow-up, and Sisi is very concerned that Islamists are going to take over that country even more so than they are right now. So he's calling for NATO to get back involved there. So he has that pressure on his western boundary. And then also he has that pressure on his eastern boundary, well, included in the Sinai Peninsula is included in Egypt, but it's east of the main population centers. And that's where we had this plane that went down. Now, it hasn't been said yet by an official investigation whether the Islamic State, their affiliate, Sinai Province, they're called down there, whether they planted the bomb on this plane or not. But you do have Russia suspending all their flights. You do have the US and the UK saying that it is likely or it's possible that there was a bomb on that plane. So you have the rising Islamist threat in the Sinai as well. Added to that, you have the economic pressures that they're facing right now with falling oil prices. It's affecting Egypt as well. Not that they have too much oil, but they were getting a lot of support from Gulf states. Saudi Arabia, Qatar were pushing in funds into Egypt to support the economic proposals and the economic programs of Sisi as well. And they don't have as much money because of the falling oil price. So they're cutting back on that as well. So he is facing, not from those different boundaries, Egypt's boundaries, the rising Islamist threat, but also what we're seeing now is world public opinion is turning against him as well. He's very much a realist, this leader. He understands that Egypt's got a choice, and it's either his strong rule, which he does put down media freedom of the press. I mean, he has arrested a lot of the people that talk against his rule. But he understands if they had a democratic election today, you would get Islamists back in power. And, you know, we've seen what that can do across the Middle East. So he's trying to maintain his own grip on power, but it looks like the world is turning against him. Even today we had the Washington Post, not the most conservative paper, but even so, they did have an article written by a leader of the Political Bureau of the Muslim Brotherhood that's currently exiled in Turkey. They wrote a piece just condemning Sisi for the rise of violence and terrorism inside Egypt, and saying that he's the reason why you have all these threats on Egyptian soil, which he is. I mean, he is the reason why there are increasing attacks. There's been assassination attempts on his life as well inside Egypt. He's the reason for it because he's trying to not let that happen. So the Islamists are trying to get rid of him. But this article's point of view was, hey, the Islamic nature of Egypt is a reality. It's a fact. And you need to step down and let the people decide who's in power. And that sounds that people decide who should rule the country. And that sounds great. That sounds great if the majority of people wouldn't elect the Muslim Brotherhood like they did previously.
Right. If they weren't paying attention to what just happened just a few years ago with Morsi taking power in a democratic election, then yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah. So
it's just amazing how the American administration has kind of, like, as they have in Iran, in a sense, they've been kind of against this guy from the very beginning and undermining what he's been trying to do in this country. And like you said, he comes with plenty of problems. But do we really think that the alternative is going to be better than what he's doing? And you look at what's happened in so many of these Middle Eastern states in the Arab Spring. Anytime a democratic movement actually takes over, you really end up with problems and chaos.
The end result is not good, at least definitely not for interests of the West. So I just wanted to mention that today because it is something that our listeners can watch and look for world public opinion to turn against him, look for terrorist attacks in Egypt to increase and the public outcry to increase for his removal, because one of these days it is going to happen.
Right. The prophecy that we continually draw attention to is the fact that there is meant to be an alignment between Iran and Egypt. And at this point, there's really animosity between those two because of one man, essentially. So if he is ousted, we could see a pretty radical and rapid change in Egyptian politics take place overnight. All right. Thank you very much, Brent. These articles that he was talking about and that we've discussed so far, they're in the Trumpet Weekly, a very informative report that we produce each week. I encourage you to subscribe to this free report. Just go online to thetrumpet.com to become a subscriber to the Trumpet Weekly. Coming up, we'll look at important news from Asia and America, and later our lightning round of headlines from all our panelists. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
You're listening to our Week in Review program, looking at the big stories from around the world this past week. We're going to turn now to Asia and to Jeremiah Jacques. Start with the overview, Jeremiah.
Okay, well, Russia is very close to clinching a massive deal to supply fifth-generation fighters to India. This is a $35 billion military armament deal. It's for 154 Russian-made fighters. And so this is just another huge sign of these two powerful Asian states working together. And then Russia is also, according to NATO's Secretary General, rapidly building up its military forces from the Baltic Sea to the Mediterranean, even in Kaliningrad. And so the Secretary General has called on the U.S.-led alliance to come up with a response, but we'll see if that happens.
All right, and your top story from Asia this week.
The top story was a surprise announcement from Taiwan and China saying that the leaders of those two nations will hold a meeting for the first time in history. The People's Republic of China and Taiwan have had a really rocky history with each other. The whole reason the two nations even exist separately is because of a bloody civil war that happened starting in the mid-1920s and went all the way until about 1950, just was sort of a break in there for the two sides to unite against Japan during World War II. But by 1950, the Communist Party had defeated the Kuomintang. So the Kuomintang sort of fled mainland China and set themselves up on the island of Taiwan. Taiwan had been a part of Japan up until the end of World War II. But after its defeat, Japan gave the island to China. So anyway, ever since then, China, under the Communist Party, has actively claimed ownership of Taiwan. It views Taiwan as kind of a breakaway rebel state. And what we don't hear about quite as often as that is that Taiwan, under the Kuomintang Party, also claims ownership of mainland China. So both sides claim to be the legitimate ruler of all of China, which is to say the island of Taiwan and mainland China together, plus a lot of smaller territories. So the situation has long been really, really tense. Taiwan has lived under fear of invasion from Chinese forces, and the U.S. in general has tried to prevent that from happening by buying lots of military equipment for Taiwan and just trying to prevent the Communist Party of mainland China from taking over Taiwan. But then in 2008... Ma Ying-jeou was elected as Taiwan's president. And ever since his election, he has made it a high priority to improve Taiwan's relationship with China. And many in Taiwan have grown really unhappy over just a whole range of agreements that he has made with mainland China. He's made 23 groundbreaking agreements, just promoting greater economic integration between the two sides. And a lot of Taiwanese are worried about this. They view this as Ma submitting to China, and they're worried about the political leverage that this gives to the Communist Party. And this historic meeting that was announced this week is just another really significant symbol of Ma's willingness to give in to China. It's hugely symbolic, but really, you can't blame Ma, because he sees the United States retreating from its role as the global stabilizer. He sees the United States abandoning allies all over the world and just kowtowing to enemies on all sorts of fronts. And it looks like Ma is saying, well, with America's security assurances just becoming so patchy and so thin and so unreliable, we had better be ready to surrender peacefully to China as it rises rather than risking a war, because it's a war that without U.S. security backing, we would be sure to lose.
You know, it's interesting. Just on Wednesday's program, I was talking to Richard about this these moves that the United Kingdom is making and really bending over backward to establish a friendship and a strong relationship with China. And essentially, the bottom line is they see which way the wind is blowing. They see this powerful nation emerging within Asia and just how much it's affecting the global economy. And they realize as well that the United States, their alliance with the United States just isn't what it used to be. And so they're really moving, turning east. And here we see a much more urgent situation for this tiny little nation that's just right in China's shadow, right next to the Chinese mainland, and really a much closer to a front row seat to what's happening in China. And they're even more urgent in trying to patch things up and to basically accommodate the new reality of today's world.
That's right. It seems like more and more nations have this choice: either stay on the sinking U.S. ship or rally behind the rising Chinese dragon. And more and more often we see them really taking a realist view and saying, we better get ready for China's rise and the decline of America. I also wanted to point out that back in 1998, Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury really made some bold statements about Taiwan coming back under mainland China's control. I want to read a short quote from an article that he wrote at that time. He said, "How could anyone fail to see that Taiwan is destined to become a part of mainland China? These 21 million people, now it's actually 23 and a half million people, but they are going to be forced into the Chinese mold, and it's going to happen for one reason, because of a pitifully weak-willed America." So that, I mean, in light of events that we've seen in the 17 years since that was written, it's just really stunning to see how accurate that forecast was.
I remember when he first said that, and Taiwan wasn't even on my radar at the time. I was just kind of amazed that he locked in on what was happening over there. But it is because of the Bible's prophecies about this Asian alliance and this juggernaut that is so forcibly propped up, or one of the pillar nations in that alliance being China, that he could see that the relationship that the United States had with Taiwan to that point just wasn't going to last.
Yes, it was a really stunning analysis, and you know, I think time has proven it true.
Very interesting. All right, thank you, Jeremiah, for that. We're going to turn our attention now to Anglo-America and to Robert Morley, starting with the overview.
Sure. The Bureau of Labor Statistics released its latest jobs report today, this morning, and they said the economy added 271,000 jobs, which is actually a pretty good figure. But when you start digging down into the numbers, it also said that there was a record number of Americans not in the labor force. There's now 93 million Americans that aren't actually participating in the labor force, which is the highest number on record. They also revised down the number of jobs.
Just so I know, the 93 million, would that include, is that just people who are, what, 18 and up? Or is that 93 million Americans total? That's like one third of America.
Yeah, almost one third of America when you start adding up the numbers of people we have, our aging population, which is playing into that. But also other factors are playing into that number, which is people discourage workers not in a labor force because they can't find a job, or they've given up looking for jobs.
Does it have kids too in that 93 million?
Mm-mm.
That's working age people. That's remarkable.
Yeah. Kind of related to this, Kraft and Heinz Co., the big manufacturers, they make, you know, all kinds of consumer products in America. They said that they are going to be closing down 7 factories in the U.S. and laying off 2,600 employees. That's about 6% of their workforce. And this kind of coincides with another report that's in the Trumpet Weekly talking about how our manufacturing sector in America is just being decimated. And that's some pretty visible proof of that. And then the last item I want to mention here is gun sales. And gun sales have hit another record for the 6th month in a row. The FBI's National Instant Background Check System processed almost 2 million firearms-related checks just in October. And that's an increase of 373,000 checks for gun purchases from this time last year. The head of the Second Amendment Foundation Group basically said that the rise in these arms sales are due to Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. They've become the best gun salesmen on the planet, and every time they speak, people go out there and guns flow off the shelves.
Right. You especially saw that probably after the last Democratic debate, where it was discussed pretty prominently. All right, so your top story this last week.
Right, top story this week is concerning a new report by a U.S. research firm. This report was published in the New York Times and elsewhere, and it concluded that the United States is erring on the side of endangering national security when it comes to letting its most technologically advanced and strategic companies do business in China. And this report took a look at how companies, American companies, are doing business in China. Particularly, it looked at IBM's partnership in China, IBM being the big hardware computing company that does so much business in China. And this report released by Defense Group said that IBM's partnerships, in particular with Chinese companies, have deep and troubling ties to the Chinese military, defense industry, and state security apparatus. And the implication is it's not just IBM that has these relations. It's hundreds and potentially thousands of American businesses now that are doing business in China. And in IBM's case, it had some very, very strong statements about the danger to America, the danger that America faces because of the transfer of IBM technologies to the Chinese government. And it also talked about the danger to U.S. corporations because U.S. corporations now are having to compete with Chinese companies that are able to gain access to technology that previously was only available in the United States. And this report went on to take a look at, IBM. A lot of this transfer technology is legitimate, but they also said a lot of it is through cyber espionage, through exploiting these relationships that are developing with U.S. companies. And this is a trend we've been watching very closely at the Trumpet, and we've been warning about this for years and years and years. I mean, when you take a look at China and you wonder, how did China rise so quickly to become the world's second biggest economy? You know, just a decade and a half ago, two decades ago, I mean, China wasn't even on a lot of people's radar in terms of global superpower economically. But over the last two decades, it's just radically closed the gap, not only economically with America, but militarily as well. And the way they've done that is by exploiting these relationships with American companies. So just to give you an example, beyond IBM, I mean, they did the same thing with IBM, but with Boeing, for example, they said, Chinese government said, we would love to buy Boeing aircraft, but we might buy Airbus aircraft. But you know what, Boeing, if you come up and you set up a factory in China and you employ Chinese engineers and you employ Chinese workers, we'll buy the planes from you. And Boeing, you know, that's the way, you know, businesses work. They look at the short term. They think, okay, we are going to do this. If we don't do it, maybe Airbus will do it. So they've gone to China, set up these factories, and lo and behold, 10 years later, 15 years later, all of a sudden we have Chinese companies completely unrelated to Boeing producing aircraft that look a lot like Boeing's. Mm. And we're seeing technology in all kinds of fields, the same sort of thing happening. As these companies have moved into China, China has just completely exploited, infiltrated and exploited that relationship to catch up to America in terms of technology. And we're starting to see now analysts and people more and more concerned about this. And they're saying that it actually threatens America militarily. Now, it's gone past the commercial aspects, but now we're seeing them catch up even militarily. And with this report about IBM, it's in supercomputing and, you know, high-speed computing that China is now challenging and rivaling America. And these analysts say it's because they've gotten that technology from U.S. corporations.
That's really fascinating. Obviously, looking at this in light of other recent stories about Chinese cyber espionage, and we know how aggressive they have been in trying to exploit America's Achilles heel of technology. Other stories that have come out in recent years about gaining the technology of U.S. spy planes and that type of thing. But I've never connected those dots the way that you just did about how much it has been that type of strategy and that kind of spying that has contributed to the Chinese miracle, that has helped to create this economic juggernaut that we see over there. It's really interesting.
Well, I even remember you wrote an article just a few years ago talking about the Pentagon intercepting like 50,000 compromised computer chips coming from China. And those computer chips, you know, they're manufactured basically under a U.S. label. It was a company that had moved to China, set up operations over there, and, you know, the Chinese started subcontracting out parts of their business to Chinese corporations. And, you know, all of a sudden now the Pentagon says, uh-oh, we have this problem. We're not actually buying U.S. products anymore. We're buying Chinese products under American label, American name. And it's compromising us potentially militarily, you know, Trojan horse type implications for the military.
Yeah, really fascinating. How many of the technologies that we're seeing, or how much of what China is doing and the strides that it's making militarily, what it's doing in the South China Sea and projecting its power elsewhere, is on the back of American technology or technology that they've stolen?
Absolutely. I think you're right. A lot of it.
Very interesting. So remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, the story that Robert is talking about here about Chinese espionage that's in this week's edition of The Trumpet Weekly. Everything else that we've been talking about there is in this edition. We're going to finish up the program with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time now for our lightning round. One last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention, starting with Brent.
This week, Iran's parliament voted to block Prime Minister Abadi from unilaterally passing anti-corruption measures and other reforms. And this is a setback for the United States. That's what the Wall Street Journal did report this week. This leader, the Prime Minister of Iraq, while he is a Shiite, he has largely been seen for the past year that he's been in power as somebody that does support America, that is thankful for America's help in fighting back the Islamic State, even as the country of Iraq is overrun by the Islamic State, and then they needed the military help of Iranian's Shiite militias. Inside the parliament, you have had America's interests being pushed and somewhat expressed there because of this prime minister. But this vote, where he was not backed by even his own coalition parties, indicates that there is a change of opinion taking place. A few months ago, he actually got rid of the role of the vice presidency inside Iraq, and one of those people that lost their job or lost their portfolio was the former Prime Minister al-Maliki, and he is the one that is in Iran's back pocket. So he wanted to get rid of him to try and, you know, stabilize the country and stabilize the direction of the country, the laws that would be passed. But while that law did get passed, Maliki went nowhere. He stayed inside the government, and it looks like the opinion inside the parliament is staying with him. This is just the final, going towards Maliki, away from Abadi, who is America's ally. This is the final part of the article here in the Trumpet Weekly. It says, Mr. Abadi's declining support among lawmakers threatens to further diminish Washington's influence by empowering Mr. Maliki and his supporters among hardline Shiite politicians and Iranian-backed Shiite militia groups, both of which have sought to check America's role. So the guy that's been restraining Iran inside Iraq looks like he's losing power.
All right, thanks very much. We'll go now to Richard.
We have an article in this week's Trumpet Weekly called A Mass Migration Crisis and It May Get Worse. And it has some great statistics about how we could just be right at the very start, just the tip of the iceberg of what's coming when it comes to refugees coming into Europe. So it talks about how we're more displaced people and refugees now than at any other time in recorded history. 60 million. And then it just goes through and lists the places where we could see many more immigrants and refugees coming from. So, for example, Afghanistan, the situation there is deteriorating. The Taliban is continuing to make gains. A quarter of Afghans said that they wanted to leave. Then you've got Syria. Things are still going on there. You've still got a whole load of Syrian immigrants in places like Lebanon, Turkey, and Jordan. They could decide to come through to Europe. In Egypt, you've got 5 million Copts, Christians there, that are worried that they might face more persecution like they did under the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. So as Egypt becomes more unstable, they could come to Europe. You've got Yemen. They've not yet sent many immigrants to Europe, but there's 25 million people in Yemen. It's as populous as Afghanistan. A lot of unrest there, so they may start coming to Europe. Then even Nigeria, 40% of people in Nigeria told one poll that they would emigrate to the West if they could. And Nigeria is it's the most populous country in Africa, and it's growing rapidly in population. So there's a whole load of potential conflicts and countries there that could just send millions upon millions of people to Europe. So we're looking at a migration crisis getting worse, not in next year or two, but over the next 5 years or more, if Europe doesn't get a handle on it.
Thank you, Richard. We'll go now to Jeremiah.
Well, Japan and China agreed this week to some really significant moves toward repairing their relationship. On Sunday, they said that they would restart mutual visits of their foreign ministers and hold high-level economic dialogue starting in 2016. And then they also said that they would restart talks about the really contentious issue of oil and gas field development in the East China Sea. Then they also said that they would be starting up a communication mechanism between their two military forces. So these are some really major moves toward just warming that relationship there that's been very strained over the years. And then the very next day, Japan, China, and South Korea met together, and they said that as a result of that meeting, they consider their relations completely restored. those three nations. So I think that this is another really telling example of what we were discussing earlier, just nations that were traditionally allies of America, at least in the post-World War II era, seeing the writing on the wall. And they are, you know, Japan and South Korea have both relied on the U.S. for so long, but now they're saying we need to be ready to be, you know, in some way allied with this rising Russo-Chinese behemoth that's coming together.
Sure, appreciate you keeping us up to date on that that developing alliance. Now on to Robert.
So Forbes this week came out with its most powerful people list. You mentioned that at the top of the hour. And for a lot of people, it was a bit of a shocker. I mean, if you were listening to this program, it probably wouldn't have been so shocking for you. But if you haven't have been, this time, for the first time ever in the history of the list, U.S. president wasn't the number one or the number two person on that list. So in the history of this Forbes Most 100 Powerful People, the United States president has always been the most powerful person on the list, number one spot or number two. This time, President Obama was ranked as number three with Vladimir Putin as number one and Angela Merkel as number two. And I think this survey just says so much about the state of America and the state of this world. If you look at America, we're the richest country in the world. We still have the biggest military in the world. We have everything going for it from a geopolitical, analytical perspective. And yet somehow President Obama, his power ranking falls to third place. And why is that? And on a lot of these analysts, as they were going through, they were adding up all these things that America has going for it, and they just couldn't figure out why Forbes would drop President Obama to number three. But one thing that I took from it, from watching some of these analyses, was just the lack of understanding of of how much willpower is involved in calculating national power and the strength of a person. If you don't have the will to use your power, then you're not powerful enough. And this world really has taken a look at what America has accomplished over this last couple of years and what America has done. And they see a lot of failures, and they see a lot of instances, as even Jeremiah just mentioned, of the world turning away from America. I think that is reflected in that Forbes ranking.
Well, thank you, Robert. I just wanted to finish with a little article that was on chicago.cbslocal.com by Jeremy Reed. This man's 8-year-old son was using the iPad quite a lot. His wife expressed some concern that this was becoming an addiction, and he kind of brushed her concerns aside. But then they had a neighborhood block party. He expected his son to participate in these events, but the boy was so absorbed in his iPad that he wouldn't do it. So he took his son's iPad away. Well, the boy pitched a massive fit, and this father realized that it was time for a more serious intervention. He says, he writes in this article, "We broke the news to my boy that we were banning the iPad for 2 days. He didn't believe we would stick to it. He yelled at me as if I had sold all of his belongings and replaced them with rocks. Like a stereotypical drug addict in the throes of withdrawal, my son offered me anything I wanted if I could give him 5 minutes with an iPad, cleaning the house, cleaning my room, and on I held my ground, despite comments like this, 'You're the worst daddy in the world. Why do you hate me? You have taken everything fun out of this world.' On day two, my son woke me up to inform me that I have ruined his life and then slammed the door. He was wearing all black. He wore all black, my daughter informed me, to show me that I had taken the color and fun out of the world. I am in complete shock at how powerful this addiction is," this man wrote. Is it possible you've got one of these addicts in your home? You know what? Give it a try. 2 days, no iPad. See what kind of reaction you get. This article concludes, "Now that a few weeks have passed, I'm happy to report that I've got my son back. Most of his crippling anxiety and anger has melted away. We held tough on keeping the iPad out of his hot little hands during the week." He says, "He hangs out with us again. He sits at the table without rushing away to get the next fix. I admit I enabled this addiction for too long. I didn't want to believe that it was a problem. I'm here now to say that I was wrong. This addiction is real." Wise words from a father on the front lines. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. We'll be happy to give you a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. The stories that we've talked about on the program today are in this week's edition. We'd love to hear from you. Email us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Follow us on Twitter @@thetrumpet_com. You can find us on Facebook and Google Plus by searching for Philadelphia Trumpet. Thanks to our panel, Brent Noctegal, Richard Palmer, Jeremiah Jacques, and Robert Morley.
You're welcome.
And thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with the words of Theodore Roosevelt. In any moment of decision, the best thing you can do is the right thing. The next best thing you can do is the wrong thing. And the worst thing you can do is nothing. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice 101.3 KPCG and on the web at kpcg.fm.